Like it or not, for it or against it, Obamacare is coming, and it's coming soon. The Affordable Care Act requires most Americans carry some form of health insurance beginning next January or pay a fee. And by this coming October 1st, and that's less than 7 months from now, states need to have health care exchanges in place where consumers can buy the required insurance. Last week, the State House agreed to let the state spend a federal grant worth nearly $31 million and help set up that health care exchange. So what does it mean for Michigan to partner with Uncle Sam in running this exchange? For the answer, we welcome back to Stateside Helen Levy. Hi, Helen.
Thanks for having me.
Helen is with the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan, and she is our resident health exchange expert. And just to get everyone on the same page, we want to backtrack just a little bit and explain to us again just what this healthcare exchange would look like and how it's supposed to work.
It's a regulated marketplace where people can buy health insurance if they don't have access to an employer-sponsored policy. So you can think of a website like Expedia or Orbitz for buying plane tickets. Think of something like that for health insurance.
And the word exchange, which we think of as let me exchange addresses with you, it's more like the old mercantile exchange. It's more the older form of that word.
That's right. And federal government has actually started just calling them health insurance marketplaces.
There you go. Now that's speaking real English. I think people would understand what that means. So last week's vote in the House basically puts Michigan in partnership with the federal government on running the exchange for our state. How would that work?
Well, the governor has said that he would like the state to take over two different functions of the exchange or the marketplace. One of those is the plan management, so contracting with the health insurance plans and making sure that they're doing what they're required to do to be in this market. And the other part of it is consumer assistance. So that's going to mean things like setting up a call center and having actual people who can answer questions from consumers.
And then what would Uncle Sam be doing?
Well, Uncle Sam will be doing all of the other stuff like verifying people's eligibility for tax credits and also carrying out a risk adjustment program. That means that if one insurer somehow manages to get a whole lot of the healthy people,
oh, yes. Okay.
They make sure that that plan has to make payments to the plans that got stuck with all the sick people so that you keep the marketplace working.
Okay. And just keep everything kind of flowing.
Yes.
Now, we know that there was the option to set up an exchange completely run by the state. And give us a little history lesson. Explain for us why Michigan's exchange will not be independent.
Well, the governor had wanted to have a purely state-based exchange, but the legislature didn't go along with him on that. And so the partnership model is a compromise, and the legislature seems to be getting behind that. As you said, they've approved spending the $31 million grant that the state got from the federal government to move to set up the state parts of the partnership model. You know, it's one of these things where there's a lot of arguing back and forth. Should it be state? Should it be federal? Should it be partnership? I honestly don't think that to consumers you're going to know the difference.
And that's what I'd wondered, because I wondered if that foot dragging, and I know that there were state lawmakers that didn't want to jump on board because they frankly wanted to see if Barack Obama would be reelected and if Obamacare and if the Affordable Care Act would be continued. So that's why that didn't happen and the deadline passed. So I wondered if that foot dragging hurt Michigan consumers in your view.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's been a long road since March of 2010 when the Affordable Care Act was passed. The health reform law has cleared a lot of political and judicial hurdles. Mm. And now, you know, the finish line or the starting gate, I guess, depending on how you want to think of it, of January 2014, it's in sight. And I think when all the dust settles, the exchange is going to be up and running. As a consumer, you're not going to look at it and say, wow, this partnership exchange, I think we would have been better off with a state exchange. You know, you're not going to visit your relatives in Minnesota and say, boy, you guys are lucky to have a state exchange. I wish we had one here. That's not to say it doesn't matter. It matters a lot to the people who are running these things. Mm. But to consumers, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference.
And frankly, that's who's listening to us talk right now. So that question is, I think, uppermost in people's minds. How will it work for me when the time comes this fall to be able to use that? And as far as looking across the country and who's getting on board with state-run exchanges or who's doing the hybrid like Michigan, where do we fit in?
So there are a few other states that have partnership models. In addition to Michigan, Illinois, Utah, West Virginia, and Iowa have all said they'll run partnership models. No one's exactly sure, just like in Michigan, no one's exactly sure how the responsibilities are going to be split up.
Yeah.
But then there are a bunch of states that are running their own exchanges. Maryland, Minnesota, Massachusetts has been running one for a while. And then, of course, there are the states that are leaving the whole thing to the federal government: Georgia, Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, just to name a few of those. So really, it's all over the map. And we're going to learn, I think, over the next few years, we're going to learn a tremendous amount about how to do this well and what works and what doesn't from watching these different examples.
What do you think, since you're so versed in this, that we can learn from Massachusetts? Because that reform kind of paved the way for a lot of this. So what has been working well and what can we learn from Massachusetts?
Well, Massachusetts, there have been lessons from Massachusetts that informed the Affordable Care Act itself. So things like you don't let people move in and out of the health insurance exchange. You don't let them change their plan on a monthly basis. You have one open enrollment period a year.
Otherwise, you'd probably go crazy with people shopping around, wouldn't
you? Exactly. People move around too much. So things like that.
Back to here in Michigan, it certainly seems clear that a lot of Republicans in the House were, shall I say, holding their noses as they voted to approve that House bill. You had House Speaker Bolger talking about, quote, protecting Michigan families from a massive and unwelcome federal overreach and accepting the responsibility to govern while facing reality. Could we see a situation where the bill that was passed by the House not clear the Senate? Because there's, you know, clearly still some sense of dislike, if you will, on the behalf of the Republicans.
You know, as I think about what the governor has said he wants the state to do, what he's really asking in wanting to set up the partnership model the way he is to let the state do the things that the state will be best at. Mm. So helping Michigan consumers, you know, the state government is here dealing with Michigan residents every day. So it makes sense for the state to run the consumer assistance part of it. Similarly, the state already regulates health insurance plans, so it really makes sense for the state to do the plan management piece of it. You know,
yes.
If you were planning an event that was going to happen, let's say you're planning your daughter's wedding and it was going to happen here in Ann Arbor, would you hire a local event planner or would you bring someone in from Washington? Well, I think you'd hire a local event planner because you're going to be dealing with a lot of Ann Arbor businesses.
Surely, surely.
And there's a sense in which all health insurance is local. So it really makes sense for the state to be doing the aspects of it that the governor has said he wants to take on in the partnership model.
So we see this, and also we're getting nearly $31 million federal dollars to help set this all up, which is, I'm sure, a very good thing considering Michigan's budget concerns.
That helps a lot.
Now, does that money, is that a constant funding or will that taper off as time goes on?
So the federal government has made available, it comes in the form of a grant to the state. So the state applies for money. And so far, the constraint has not been the availability of the funds. It's been states, you know, like Michigan was a couple of years ago, not wanting to do it.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that plays out over the next few years.
So to be determined as far as whether that $31 million stays. But I guess I'm hearing we didn't leave money, federal money, sitting on the table.
Not this time, no. And it should be noted that the exchanges or the marketplaces are supposed to be financially self-sustaining after a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to be somehow making it work themselves without a continued infusion of funds from the federal government.
So this is almost like federal seed money.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
So if you and I were sitting here and having this conversation, let's say 5 years from now, and the Affordable Care Act continuing to reshape the face of healthcare, the exchange has been up and running for a while, what do you think the picture will look like in Michigan for medical consumers?
I think it will be good. I think it will be better than it is now. And I think, honestly, we'll all be looking back and we're going to be saying, what was the big deal? You know, we're going to be saying this made another way of getting affordable health insurance available to people. And now that it's part of our landscape, thinking, if we were five years from now, I can't imagine what it would be like without that, because that's so basic. And it didn't turn the world upside down. It just made things a little more secure for Michigan families and families across the country to have that option available.
All right. Now we're back in March of 2013, and we know that come this coming October, so in less than 7 months, the exchange is up and running. What should smart consumers be doing now to prepare for that? Is there anything they can do, I guess?
Sure. So people who currently have employer-sponsored health insurance mm-hmm. don't need to do much of anything. But people who are currently buying health insurance for themselves directly from an insurance company, or certainly people who are uninsured, should be keeping their eyes open for information about where and when they're going to be able to enroll. So October 1st is the go-live date for the enrollment. That's the open enrollment period, and then the coverage starts in January of 2014.
Helen, thanks for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Helen Levy is with the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra has just wrapped up its Beethoven Festival to great acclaim and great ticket sales. And for the finale, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the DSO streamed it, that final concert, in high def over the internet. That's one clear sign the DSO is finding new ways to reach more people and become a true 21st century orchestra and to reach its goal of becoming the most accessible orchestra on the planet. Just what does it take to keep the DSO thriving and to make it a more sustainable business? Paul Hogel's the man who's been tasked with that very challenge. He is the executive vice president of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and Paul joins us in the studio. Welcome to Michigan Radio, Paul.
Hello.
Well, you were recruited in early 2010 from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, and you were certainly part of fundraising efforts for Chicago and Baltimore and Indianapolis. So what was it about the DSO that made you say, yes, I'll come to Detroit?
When I first visited here, Ann Parsons said to me, come and spend a half a day. And if you don't catch the enthusiasm for the Renaissance that's happening in Detroit, go back to Atlanta, return to your family, and enjoy the rest of your career. So I got on a plane. I came in the middle of March in 2010. It was very snowy. Now, I grew up in Cleveland, so I remembered the snow.
You know from snow, yeah.
I do. But I had been away for a very long time. I came, and I'm sure this is a little bit made up, but within a few hours, I could get a sense of what was happening in Detroit. And I decided right then I had to be part of it, that there was something magical happening in the city in general and at the orchestra in particular, and I wanted to be part of that.
What do you think that was? What was that something magical?
I think there's something in the DNA in southeastern Michigan that craves and actually requires a great orchestra. I don't think Michiganders or Detroiters would put up with an average institution, an institution that didn't perform well, that didn't serve its community well, that didn't have education programs that were wide-reaching. I just don't think we'd put up with it. And that's really exciting because that is not true in every city in America.
And it is certainly I know when we talked to Maestro Slatkin, it's certainly the reputation of the musicians drew him to Detroit. And the whole idea is to have a world-class orchestra. At the same time, here's a city with a lot of financial troubles, a region of Michigan that has had a real rough time. Certainly that was felt financially, and there were some tough decisions that had to be made. And that led, with the pay cuts and retrenching that you had to do, led to that long, long strike. I'm sure that stretch, October 4th, 2010, it began and lasted till April 9th, 2011. You can tell me down to the minute, right?
Yeah, I remember it very well.
What did that episode say to really orchestras across America about the realities of the business of running an orchestra?
Well, I think the most shocking thing to me as someone who's been in this field for almost 30 years is how fragile these great institutions are. And at the same time, we have found a place in our community where performing more concerts in a single venue, sometimes isolated from everything that's going on around us in the community, does not reconcile with the general community. So orchestras like the Detroit Symphony, throughout its history, have always been involved in its community in more than just sitting in its home concert hall. But during the strike and immediately thereafter, we recommitted to this objective of being the most accessible orchestra, not just digitally, but also by physically returning to our roots and going into communities across Southeast Michigan. So here we are, one of the great orchestras in this country, performing a substantial series of concerts in downtown Detroit. But we're also doing 24 concerts in 6 neighborhood venues around Southeast Michigan. We're also visiting another dozen or so communities beyond those neighborhoods in full orchestra concerts in schools and public auditoriums and churches and synagogues. That's most major orchestras in this country. do concerts in their hometown, and then they travel someplace else to present their music. Mm-hmm. They do their residencies someplace else, summer festivals, places far south, not Detroit. We decided to do residencies for our own communities. That's what's part of the magic here.
And when you talk about making the Detroit Symphony a more sustainable business, you have to build fans for the future. We see that in sports. We see when the Red Wings have free T-shirt night, get the kids in. You've got to grow your future audiences.
Yeah, that's another one of those exciting elements about working here. There is a generational belief that the orchestra is important. The same way, I think, you can come here and be a huge fan of the Red Wings or the Tigers or the Lions or the Pistons. You don't necessarily have to go to a lot of hockey games to catch the Red Wing fever. I'd never seen a hockey game before I moved here. I've been a small package ticket holder now, and I think I'm thrilled about going. I think I see the same thing with the orchestra. People believe that having a great orchestra is part of what a great American international city has. And whether they come to concerts all the time or they're just proud to say, hey, that's my orchestra down there, it works both ways.
And what's being done to, I guess, take the DSO beyond the Southeast Michigan area, but the idea of letting Michigan feel that it has a stake in the DSO?
I think there are two things that we're doing right now. One is definitely our webcast series. So here we are, the only orchestra in the United States and only one of two in the world webcasting our concerts. So every week a classical concert can be seen live and for free on the internet. You can watch it on your computer, on your PDA, on your iPad, all those devices. So that's one thing that distinguishes us. But a second thing is we are taking our music out live. This year we'll be at Carnegie Hall as part of the Spring for Music Festival. It's the first time in 17 years that we've been to Carnegie Hall, so this is a huge deal. But not only are we performing at this festival, we're actually the only orchestra to be performing twice in the history of this festival. So that's a great honor in me. We're going to carry the Detroit and the Michigan flag, so to speak, all the way to New York. The second thing is we have a regular touring program in Florida, and we have been to Florida. We were there the year I got here in 2010, and we will be returning on a regular basis. We have a huge following in Florida, so that's another part of us going and being with the audiences that love us.
Are some of these community concerts that you're talking about outside of Southeast Michigan? For example, could you see yourself in Traverse City or on the West Side?
We absolutely could. We have been talking with some presenters in Traverse City right now about coming up with some small ensembles and visiting there on a regular basis. We have a great relationships with our friends at Interlochen Art Center, which is a fantastic resource in Interlochen. We have been to Ann Arbor recently here and performed the Magnificent Hill Auditorium, and we are in regular conversations with our friends in East Lansing about returning there. So we will go anywhere.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty, and I am speaking with the Executive Vice President of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Paul Hogel, who joined the orchestra in early 2010. So as you've been through the tough times with the musician strike and some tough financial decisions that had to be made, where do you feel now 2 years later? How would you portray the financial health of the DSO?
We're definitely stronger. We're not out of the woods, but we're definitely stronger. We are selling more tickets than we were. We have a growing base of audience, which is outstanding. We have 100% increase in the number of donors making a contribution to us. We have, with the help of our friends at the five banks who owned the debt on our expansion project, who participated mightily in resolving that, we now fully own all of our property. So these are all tremendous assets. We know in our long-range plan that was adopted by the board in December, we know the blueprint to complete sustainability. And it involves returning to certain sales levels, sustaining our annual giving levels, and building an endowment commensurate with other orchestra sizes. These things are not surprises to us, but the numbers are now on paper and very well known for the next chapter of our sustainability.
When you think about your vision for the future, and you've opened it up now with On Digital DSO, where it's a whole new world there. Also, you have partnered up with the likes of Kid Rock, for instance. Now, how important is it for the DSO to be like seen on YouTube playing an Eminem song or partnering up with Kid Rock? Is that crucial to your future growth?
I think orchestras throughout history have always found a way to straddle the line between the classic world that we live in and the contemporary existence that we thrive on. I found the Kid Rock experience to be thoroughly enjoyable. I was in the Fox Theater with 5,000 people watching our orchestra and Leonard Slatkin, who was masterful, working with this really contemporary, very popular, beloved artist. And I will never forget at the beginning of the concert, we did about 20 minutes of classical repertoire. Okay. And Leonard was brilliant. He selected the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth for one of the openings. So here we are, a whole auditorium full of 5,000 people. I'm sure most of these people had not really heard the orchestra live before. And Leonard gives the downbeat, do-do-do-do. And the people just stood up and screamed, yes,
oh boy.
Yes. It was like being at a rock concert for an orchestra. And it was so exciting because it was their orchestra. It was the Detroit Symphony Orchestra performing. What a great night for us. And I think it earned us some fans, both in the general sense of, oh, this is my orchestra, mm-hmm. and maybe I'll go try this out someday.
But important not to lose the vision of the classical side of
Correct.
Things.
Correct. You know, at the end of the day, an orchestra was created to perform the great masterworks mm-hmm. that feature a full string ensemble, a full wind symphony. You know, it's this balance. We are what we are, and I'm very proud of that. But I'm also very proud that orchestras like the Detroit Orchestra is so nimble that they can perform a wide collection of music with great confidence and with great artistic levels. That's why the Kid Rock concert worked. To hear his band partnering with a full string and brass section, it was really impressive.
Are there any future plans? Do you have your covetous eye on any other artists?
I will say that we are in discussions about what we are familiarly calling Kid Rock 2, the concept of a next generation concert. He's being helpful, very helpful with us in trying to put that together, maybe as early as this summer, and I'd say stay tuned.
Stay tuned there. Finally, where do you hope to see the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, let's say 10 years from now?
I'm usually uncomfortable with the word model. I don't know quite what a model is when so many American cities are so different. Their communities are different. Their orchestras, their histories are different. However, I think what's happening here in Detroit as a city and as an orchestra does present opportunities for how an orchestra might be sustainable in the 21st century. Here's an orchestra that is going to perform at the highest level on the artistic scale. We're attracting candidates from all over the world for open positions. It's very exciting. And I see a renewed sense of excitement of our legacy players in that work. But I also see our work in education and in community engagement and in service, that things that will never be talked about widely, but we do week after week. 1,000 kids in our education programs every week come into our life to be mentored. I think musicians are in hospitals this very day working with music therapists in professional settings in things that will never be publicized but are meaning a great deal to those patients that are involved. I think this is what 10 years looks from now. It's not an orchestra that is constantly worried about its fragility. It's actually an orchestra worried about achieving all the opportunities that it sees before us, kind of a renaissance along the lines of what the city is experiencing.
Paul Hogel is the Executive Vice President of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Paul, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Time now to introduce you to a Michigan-born filmmaker who's attracting a lot of buzz with his first full-length film. What kind of buzz? Well, the film Toys House got its debut at none other than the Sundance Film Festival. And that's quite a big boost for its director, who grew up in Royal Oak, was the jokester in his AP classes at Don Darrow High School. Joining us now from Los Angeles is filmmaker Jordan Vogt Roberts. Hey, Jordan.
Hey, how you doing?
Very, very well. So tell us, from inside the business, how big is it to get your first-time director for a full-length film getting a slot at Sundance? How big a deal is that?
I mean, it's huge. You know, like, I'm a firm believer that people who use the word game changer generally don't know what the term game changer means. But Sundance truly is, it's a game changer. It's pretty crazy. You know, if you look at the numbers statistically, mm-hmm. I think like 6,000 people submit films each year, and they select 16 to be in dramatic competition. So, you know, the odds of that are like 0.001% or something. you know, look, at the end of the day, Sundance isn't the end-all be-all of it, but it certainly is, like, one of the first real validating things that you have, you know, like, because you've been locked away in a dark room trying to make this thing great, and then for Sundance, of all places, to come and say, hey, we want to premiere this to the world, it's incredibly validating, you know? It's just sort of that huge pat on the back that says, hey, remember when you killed yourself for the last 9 months? Like, hey, maybe it was worth it.
Jordan, tell us about Toys House. I know it's about three teenage boys.
Yeah, Toys House is a coming-of-age comedy about these three teenage boys who run away into the woods and build a house. For me, it's a comedy, but the big thing, and I'm excited for people to start seeing it this summer when it's released, but it sort of has like a throwback vibe to it, sort of early Amblin movies like Goonies or Back to the Future, mixed with sort of like the heart of a John Hughes movie. And it really is, it's just about the very simple idea of walking out of the theater and saying, oh man, being 14 was the best, and then immediately following that up with, I'm so glad I'm done with that because that was the most painful, awkward, horrible time in my life, but it's what makes you who you are. I feel very fortunate that a lot of our reviews, and I'm honored and almost dumbfounded by this, but a lot of our reviews have been comparing us and sort of calling us like a contemporary Stand By Me. You know, Stand By Me is a movie about kids, but yes, it's really for adults looking back. You know, and Toys House is a very nostalgic movie.
I'm kind of wondering, I know you grew up in Royal Oak, then you got moved out to Arizona, but then you came back to Royal Oak to live with your grandma. Does that kind of resonate with the story of these boys?
Honestly, you know, it's funny. Like you said, I moved to Arizona when I was 14, which is the height of teen angst. And I was always old for my age, so I made this weird promise to myself of when I'm 18, I'm going to move back and I'm going to live on my own, basically. And thus began this incredible and influential year of my life where I almost had no one to answer to. And it really didn't dawn on me until much later the similarities between living in my grandmother's attic in Oak Park and a bunch of boys running away into the woods to build a house and having no one to answer to. And so in retrospect, it was this thing where it's just like, oh, of course, duh. Like, how could I miss that? The thematic similarities are pretty striking. But at the time, honestly, it was almost lost on me.
Huh. What kind of distribution did you get for Toys House? So how likely is it that audiences will be able to see it this summer?
Very likely. CBS Films, who are a great company, they actually just bought the new Coen Brothers movie and will be releasing that.
Yeah.
They are incredibly enthusiastic about the movie and will be releasing it this summer. We don't have an exact release date yet, but we will hopefully be announcing that soon. And yeah, so people will, you know, it's not going to be like a VOD deal or something like that. Like, you'll be able to go into a theater this summer and see our movie.
Have you thought about what it'll be like to walk into, oh, I don't know, the right in Royal Oak and walk into that theater and go, this is my movie and I used to hang out here?
Yeah, I've very much thought about the idea of, you know, all of my friends used to work at the Main Art Theater.
Yep.
And we would just hang out there and we would just go there after school, and I would tear ticket stubs for them and just, you know, eat their popcorn. And, yeah, the idea of going to the Main Art or
imagine,
you know,
Royal
Oak Field or something like that is pretty surreal. But, you know, it's exciting.
Jordan, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Filmmaker Jordan Vogt Roberts, who recently debuted his first full-length film, Toys House, at the Sundance Film Festival. He spoke to us from Los Angeles. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we're more than 3 years into an economic recovery, but as we in Michigan battle our way back to that recovery, it's a fair question to wonder, when will we get our jobs back to where they were before the Great Recession came smashing its way into our lives? According to a new forecast from IHS Global Insight, it's an economics and financial forecasting firm, the answer seems to be don't hold your breath. Even though six states have made their way back to their peak employment levels, meaning the pre-Great Recession levels, the news is not as bright for Michigan. Joining us to explain from Philadelphia is Bob Tamarelli. He's an economist with IHS Global Insight. Welcome to Stateside, Bob.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you for having me. How are you today?
Good. So when it comes to getting back to peak employment, is it fair to say your forecast finds that Michigan is way back at the end of the employment train?
Well, it's not necessarily it's way back at the end of the employment train, more so that it's just going to take a little more time than some of the other states, particularly because Michigan lost so many jobs throughout the recession. It's going to take a little bit longer to recover all those jobs.
So we've got six states that have already recovered and mm-hmm. six more expected to recover this year, and most states recovering in 2014 and then 2015. Where does that leave Michigan, Nevada, and Rhode Island?
Well, they're all pegged to see a return to peak employment after 2018. You know, Nevada obviously saw a great deterioration due to the collapse of the housing market, and they're going to be digging their way out of that. Rhode Island, similar to Michigan, is going to be dependent on the manufacturing sector, and Rhode Island, similar to Michigan, also had an economy that was not in great shape leading up to the recession.
Okay.
Particularly for Michigan, you're looking at, about 500,000 jobs that were lost throughout the recession and also a deterioration of the housing market as well. We're seeing a slower return in the housing market in Michigan. We're seeing that as a fact of we've seen a poor quarterly pattern closing out 2012 in terms of employment. So while there has been some decent employment growth over the past 3 years in recovery, it actually began to decelerate a little bit, and we saw payrolls contract a little bit in the fourth quarter. Mm. So without having consistent, strong payroll growth, that makes it difficult to support the sort of household formation that's going to support the housing market rebound, and that's going to also delay the recovery of the economy on the whole, as one's going to feed off the other. So you're still looking at recovering 500,000 jobs. They've recovered about 140,000 in the past 3 years, but that still leaves 260,000 jobs to recover. So Michigan did lose quite a bit of jobs. They're seeing good performance in the manufacturing sector on average over the past 3 years, and similar in the professional and business services sector. Those are going to be two employment sectors that are really going to drive the recovery. But again, closing out the year did not give it closing out the year on not great footing is not going to give it a great start to 2013. We're looking for it to perform below average in 2013, eventually to get up close to where the nation's moving in the middle of the five-year forecast. But then as the five-year forecast is closing down, we expect to see manufacturing employment begin to decelerate and even decline a little bit in some areas, including Michigan and in Detroit. So that's going to also hinder the pace of recovery as well.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking with economist Bob Tamarelli. He's with IHS Global Insight, a forecasting firm which just issued a forecast that predicts that Michigan will not make its way back to peak employment levels, which means basically the pre-Great Recession levels, until 2018 or perhaps even later. And Bob, I'm wondering, talk a little if we can about manufacturing, particularly the auto industry, with such incredible pressure on the automakers to cut costs and be more streamlined and be more efficient, and some of that predicated by the bailout for Chrysler and General Motors. You've got jobs outsourced to Mexico and elsewhere. You have streamlined production. You have robotics. Is it not fair to assume that we in Michigan will never reach those peak employment levels again?
It's very difficult to say whether or not you'll ever reach those peak employments. I know we are looking for you to reach those peak employments at a certain time, just not within the next 5 years. There's going to be good growth in manufacturing and professional business services over the next 5 years, as I mentioned before. We'll see it tail off a little bit in manufacturing. But then again, there'll be other sectors, and Michigan will have a chance to begin to structure its economy in a way that's not so reliant on manufacturing. I believe it's about over 13% of the total non-farm employment in Michigan is located in manufacturing, whereas you're looking at around a little bit above 8% on the national level. So you can see how much more heavily leveraged Michigan is in manufacturing. So while there will be some good growth there, and there will be jobs returning there, and that will support economic stimulus in the short run, in the long term it's muted, and you're right, there is going to be some negative side effects of that. However, again, there's always an opportunity to sort of bring in a structured economy that's more based around the services sector as well.
It certainly fits into many discussions that we've heard from experts here on Stateside about the higher the education, the better workers will be for this new economy that we're going to be seeing, with moving away from those old school manufacturing jobs. So it's such a part of our state discussion, which makes me kind of wonder, in terms of policy and in terms of politics, what do you think Michigan lawmakers and business leaders should take away from the forecast?
I think it's important to take away that the number one thing is that Michigan deteriorated greatly, and it's going to take longer for Michigan to recover than it did some areas that didn't deteriorate as quickly and as severely. You know, the states that have already recovered, for instance, Texas, didn't see nearly the sort of damage during the recession as Michigan did. And therefore, of course, it's going to recover to its peak employment levels faster. The other thing to take away is certainly to drive incentives for education and drive availability and access to education. Like you stated before, just the higher educated, the better equipped you are moving within the economy. And even not necessarily moving to services, but also being highly educated in terms of being highly skilled for higher skilled manufacturing jobs as well, which is someplace that Michigan could also look to compete. So there are places to compete within manufacturing and places to compete outside of manufacturing that, of course, bringing in as much technology and as much education as possible will make them much more competitive, not to say that they're not already a home to skilled workers, because they are, but make sure to maintain that level of competition, maintain the strive and the incentive and the access to education will certainly bode well for the economy in the future. And there's a lot of that going on with the University of Michigan, Michigan, and their research that they do, a lot of high tech and a lot of research and development that happens that does fuel a lot of job growth within the state itself.
And for workers who are in that, the pools of that, those 260,000 jobs we have not yet regained, people who are either out of a job or they are underemployed, I'm trying to think, is there anything hopeful in this forecast? Is there anything to tell people not to pack up and move elsewhere where jobs seem to be regaining?
Well, the hopeful things that we've seen, not just in the forecast, but historically, is this. We've seen net migration out of Michigan decline to the point where population of Michigan actually did expand for the first time in a decade.
Yes.
So that's great. That's fantastic for Michigan. And we are seeing the beginnings of the recovery in the housing market. That will help fuel the recovery in the overall economy as well. And we're also we expect to see accelerated growth in jobs, not just in manufacturing, but non-manufacturing sectors as well. And there is a base of highly skilled workers in Michigan that could benefit from those manufacturing jobs, particularly in the short run, and also access to education at the state universities and the ability to hopefully draw in some high-tech companies and maybe some more service companies certainly bodes well.
Bob Tamarelli is an economist with IHS Global Insight, and he was kind enough to join us from their office in Philadelphia. Bob, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Cindy. Thank you for having me.
The state Supreme Court began hearing cases this week with a full bench, with Governor Snyder's appointment of new Justice David Viviano to replace former Justice Diane Hathaway. It was the first time in about 6 weeks that the court has had seven sitting justices. And, of course, Diane Hathaway had to step down from the court in January and has since pleaded guilty to a federal bank fraud charge in connection with a family real estate deal. Detroit News columnist Laura Berman has been giving a lot of thought to the appointment of Justice David Viviano. Her column in Tuesday's Detroit News reflects a sense of disappointment in Governor Snyder's choice of a man to replace Diane Hathaway. So we wanted to talk to her about that, and Laura Berman joins us now. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Cynthia. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. And clearly, by reading your column, it rankled you that that David Viviano was put in there, and we now have five men and two women on the high court. Why did that strike such a nerve with you?
Well, it really did, and it startled me a little. But I think, you know, nothing against Judge Viviano, who I understand is a very intelligent man and a good judge. But I think there's a sense of frustration that I feel that women have been relegated to sort of minority status in leadership roles in public life, even though women are not a minority. And despite the increase of women in the pipeline, you know, there used to always be this conversation about for a long time that we need women in the pipeline. But law is a place where women have been half of the pipeline for a long, long time already.
Yes.
And while women are judges and are on the U.S. Supreme Court, it's still in a very minority role. And I think, you know, women in Michigan and voters in Michigan have been electing women to the court. But what we saw here is the governor using his appointive power twice, not once, but twice, to reduce the number of women on the court. So, you know, I have this feeling that women are kind of like seasoning you know.
Like salt, use lightly.
You can put a dash on, but there's no critical mass.
Well, let me ask you this, and we'll talk. We'll focus just on the Supreme Court versus all of public life or policymaking. But when I think about the law, and I even see that statue with the scales of justice, and that statue's blindfolded. So I'm wondering, is it not really supposed to be a point of view that is really all about the law and blind to gender?
Yes, but, you know, the problem is that this idea of I've picked the best qualified candidate, which, you know, is essentially the governor's position, is so often used as a kind of red herring. Mm. And, you know, one of the examples I was thinking about is Sandra Day O'Connor. You know, when she was first appointed to the Supreme Court, no one would have said she was the best qualified person in the country. She was a state appeals court judge. She hadn't been on the bench that long. And so it was really quite an affirmative action leap to put her there. And yet, I think after she had served on the court, no one would argue that she had added something, you know, she had become influential and had added something very important to the court that, you know, another man would not have done. And, you know, there's also a lot of research that does show that diversity of gender creates a smarter group.
Yeah, talk a little about that study. You cited it in your column.
Yeah, and I didn't mention it at length, but there was this study done by some business researchers, men and women actually, where they took 192 teams, they measured all their IQs, and they had them do complex problems. And they discovered that the IQs of the people on, you know, they could tell who was the smartest group, but the smartest groups didn't necessarily solve the problems best. The groups that had more women did. And they theorized that having, you know, different points of view, different ways of listening, different ways of thinking made the whole group smarter. And that, you know, there are gender differences in terms of these things, which is funny because we argue there are none and then there are some.
And then there's something like this. And you know, I honestly can think that over my career, as I encounter women in fields who reach a level of accomplishment, a lot of these women are very clear. They don't want to be seen as a woman anything. They want to be a CFO or they want to be a reporter or a judge. They don't want to, I get the sense, carry that banner for being a woman.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, and I think everybody feels that way, and I think there's something awkward even about discussing this in terms of numbers. And yet, you know, so many, you know, this is 50 years since the feminine mystique, and there isn't really one institution where women are even half. Hmm. Now, if women are 20%, that's considered, you know, as in the Senate, I think people think that's a huge gain. But it gets back to the idea of, do you have enough critical mass to really be important, and why are women still a minority when they're not a minority?
Okay, I have to put this out here, Laura, because you put it out in your column, and I read a lot of comments from your readers about this. Let's put it out here. Here you have Diane Hathaway, who had that prime piece of real estate, that seat on the high court, and she frankly blew it big time with a corrupt, fraudulent real estate deal. So how do you answer those who say, forget the political litmus test, let's have an honest, competent legal mind on the bench, and who cares whether it's a man or a woman?
And I guess my I agree with that up to a point. You know, one of the things I thought about is, let's appoint a woman every time a man goofs up. You know, every time a man is corrupt or makes a mistake, should we appoint a woman? And again, we get back to the best qualified. There is no objective best qualified person.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's very hard to figure now. And I think what I wanted to do was also just, you know, point out that if you only you, why are women being stuck at say 20 to 30% of the Supreme Court? It never goes higher than that.
Yeah.
And there's a census that Sheryl Sandberg of who's just written this book Lean In, talking about women trying to reach for the top as opposed to just sort of making it in the middle.
Now, would you, Laura, aim the same observations and criticisms at the Obama White House? Because, boy, there are sure a lot of white men in his cabinet, and he did take a lot of criticism. Would you apply that same argument against President Obama in the way he constructed his cabinet?
You know, I don't. I mean, he had a female Secretary of State, and I know he just appointed several women. But, you know, I don't want there to be a litmus test. What bothered me specifically about this was that Snyder has used his appointment power twice to reduce the number of women on the court. And I wanted him to know that people were watching, and I want people to know and think about it. Because at a time when people are electing women, you don't want the executive branch to reduce the power of women.
Laura Berman, very, very good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Laura Berman is a columnist for the Detroit News. And before we sign off for this afternoon, we've got a piece of interesting news. The Michigan Supreme Court is now streaming oral arguments live on the web. The court began broadcasting its caseload in 1996 through Michigan Government Television. That service stopped in December, so the court decided that live streaming was the right solution. Marcia McBride is a spokeswoman for Michigan Supreme Court. She says the web reaches a new audience for the high court.
This way, the public has the ability to go directly to the hearing electronically and see for themselves what's going on and get the whole story.
And for all of you law buffs out there, the court is also archiving video of its hearings on the Michigan State Bar's virtual court website. All the information is on our website at michiganradio.org.